once again for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Joining me in the studio today, as is her wont on the third Sunday of every month, is North Carolina Poet Laureate Kathy Smith Bowers. Kathy, hello. How are you today?
I'm fine, Jeff Davis. How are you?
Let me give you some microphone. That would be better. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Jeff?
I'm doing great. Yes, yes. And you have a special guest with you today.
That's I do.
Catherine Soniat.
It is a pleasure to have as our guest today, poet Catherine Soniat. Is it Soniat or Soniat?
Soniat.
Soniat.
Uh-huh.
Catherine is the author of several books, including Alluvial, published in 2001, and earlier collections that include Cracking Eggs, Notes of Departure, Winter Toys, and A Shared Life, and forthcoming in 2011 and 2012, The Swing Girl and A Raft, A Boat, A Bridge. Her honors and awards and prizes are numerous and include the Camden Poetry Prize, the William Faulkner Prize, and a Jane Kenyon Prize. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you.
Catherine, I've had the great pleasure recently of reading an online chat book, The Fire Setters. And the note said that this chat book would be included in a full length called Blue Oxygen. Is that full length out, or has that plan changed, or what?
I think that the title has changed to The Swing Girl.
Okay.
Oh, that's
yes.
What became The Swing Girl. Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So that's yes. The forthcoming,
uh-huh.
The Swing Girl.
That'll
so those,
be out next year from LSU Press.
Those wonderful poems, just The Fire Setters. I just,
thank you.
I'm absolutely stunned. They're poems that I think in terms of having both head and heart, and I think those are the most powerful poems. So, Catherine, your work, you've said, seems to fall into three stages of development.
Mm-hmm.
So, would you share that with us tonight, and also include some reading?
Yes, I will.
Okay. What
Thank
about
you.
We want? Just go ahead and start telling us about maybe that first stage or whatever.
Okay.
However you want to begin.
I think that my first stage of writing poems starts, as many poets and writers do, with personal poems and poems about when we were young.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the poems after those more personal poems, I know that I have kept the personal in my poems, but I have learned to tuck the personal under the edges.
Yeah.
And it moved from the personal poems to poems more about history, with the personal tucked in, and then more recently it has moved to poems about geology, geography, and place.
Mm-hmm.
And the personal is always under the edges.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I would start with reading a poem from my first book, Notes of Departure, and it's called Summer Resurrection. When I arrived in New Orleans as a child, I lived in an apartment where the child downstairs had a very elderly grandmother who had a picture of Jesus over her mantle, as everybody in New Orleans did, and she told us that if we stared at Jesus long enough, that he would blink his eyes for us. So this is about that. He did blink his eyes. Summer Resurrection. For moments or afternoons late into summer, we practiced a childhood ritual. I offered myself and my friend up to her grandmother's mystery. Votive lights like cave torches flickered on her mantle, lit the dim July of an indoor afternoon. She whispered how the framed Jesus hanging above the smoky wicks could be brought blinking into life if only we stared hard. We fixed our eyes, wide, steady, waiting for awe, and in that candle dark, Jesus grew. The streetcar rumble, cicadas shrill with rain, our own breathing disappeared into the holy land of an old woman's shade-slatted room. We practiced going blind till her Jesus assented and blinked us forward. Summer rose and fell upon the dark magic of those moments, 2 6-year-olds and a god exchanging glances across the fade of afternoon.
Wow.
Nice.
So
nice.
I can still remember that picture, you know.
Oh, wow.
He's
yeah.
still blinking yeah. his eyes.
So, Catherine, that the really powerful line, the whole poem is so powerful and just evocative, and would you read that wonderful line again about the Holy Land?
Yes, yes. Read the line to me.
The Holy Land of her living room, or something like
right,
that.
Right, 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 right. The lights flickered in the holy land of a summer afternoon.
I love that. It's one of the things I noticed as I was reading your poems, that you have those that wonderful way of, you know, tucking allusion in, and it just you weave those in so beautifully. So that's in a fresh way of saying.
Thank you.
Saying things too, having us look at those old images and myths and.
Yes, I see now where it says the holy land of an old woman's shade slatted room.
Mm-hmm.
So it brings
land.
The holy land into her little tiny apartment.
Right. The holy land of an old woman's shade slatted room.
Yeah.
Say that three times. I love what you do with sound. I'm very interested in these last few years with the physiology of sound, so and how it affects the physical body. So that line really does resonate.
Thank you.
Powerfully.
Yeah.
So
I know another poet who works kind of like that.
You know what?
Another poet who works kind of like that.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
I want to ask you.
Kathy.
Yeah, but maybe that's why I love it when I'm, you know, blown away by a line like that.
Thank you.
The music. I wouldn't be surprised if you weren't a Gerard Manley Hopkins fan too.
I love all of that.
Yeah,
yes.
Back yes. Not. Yeah. Well. I'd love to hear some more.
Okay. Sure. This poem, many of my poems when I was young seemed to focus around my mother's, because as a child I felt like I was being left a lot. And I think it's interesting when I look over the whole body of work how I've learned to tuck my mother under the edges, because in the first two books she was very, very prominent. And so this is a poem called Missing, and it's about my childhood. Once the question was how to begin, alone, with no one to receive the words. Childhood was the hollow red barn you left me in, calling for warm-breathed family, mother, father, brother, sister. Then standing back, I looked and stopped short. There was no one, and never was, only a child's dream of plenty. The Christmas card family, a sled with people blanketed and smiling. So many one was bound to care. Reality was me and what there was of you, mother, daughter, double or nothing, and the quarters were too close, you and I sharing one bed. There was little laughter in our December blankets, you breathing whiskey, settling in late, or slipping off quietly from bed to bureau through doors in the dark. There was some man's voice you kept hearing, or I kept hearing you hear. Early, too, you left. I ate alone, crowding the table with imagined family. A twilight quiet sank. The day was a story that couldn't begin to be told.
Wow. So, Catherine, where was that childhood? What was the geographical landscape of that childhood in reality? You've got the barn.
Yeah, in reality, it was in New Orleans. Someone once told me about this poem. He said, you have to take out the red barn. You never had a red barn in childhood. And I said, nope, but the red barn of childhood is going
That's
to stay
right.
There.
Yeah, absolutely.
Take care of your imagination.
As I tell my students, in poetry, we owe no loyalty to the facts.
No.
Whatsoever.
No, we
you know,
don't.
If it serves the poem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine.
Yeah.
I'm glad we don't.
No, so I agree completely.
Beautiful.
Nice.
Gorgeous poem.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So,
let's hear another piece.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a poem about when my sister was born, and I think it shows my proclivity. It starts to show my proclivity to telling family stories in terms of nature. When my sister was born, she was 2 months premature, and my mother had to stay in bed for those last couple of months of her pregnancy with a fan in New Orleans. It was very, very hot the summer in July, June. This is called Myrtle Tree. It is human in spring to want to begin. To begin in time, time depends on who is looking at it. And today, sister, I am seeing time through you. It is July as I set off down a muddy path, a voice calling through the myrtle tree. Sister, sister, you've got a new sister. A lizard stops in the fence vine to puff his throat. He is wary and slow to move, and I stand featuring myself close to my mother on the bed, the fan creaking that whole month of June while she sweated and did not move so you could be born. You will never remember this. This was when time had no before, before the world was set in motion by a voice in the myrtle tree. And to this day, I can remember that lizard in the vines and the person up on the screened-in back porch saying, "You've got a new sister," and everything just stopped. And
well,
the lizard was there.
And all, what powerful tension there, because you've got that lovely idea of you've got a new sister, and then immediately there's that lizard, which can talk about resonating on so many different levels. I totally did not expect that lizard to appear there at that moment, and obviously you did not either.
He's very reptilian, isn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he's very reptilian. Uh-huh. So you do a marvelous job of transporting the reader or the listener to that time and place, because I felt that jolt.
Thank
you.
Whoa.
Good stuff.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And I love to give my poems titles. When I was teaching at Virginia Tech, sometimes students would say, "I don't give titles to my poems." And I said, "Well, you're missing a bet." So I thought that Myrtle Tree really extended the poem as almost the tree of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't understand why, you know, and it's often young, you know, beginning writers, they just don't want to give titles to the poems. And
I think they think it makes it a grander poem by not giving it a title, but I don't
so
know
too.
Why.
I can't figure that out either, so we're on the same page with that idea.
Yeah.
So read us another one from this particular stage.
This is a poem, and again, this is when I lived in Catawba in Virginia. And I was very impressed with the countryside because I had always lived in a city. And this takes a lot of countryside images, and it starts to move very, very fast. As many, when I get away from a narrative mode into a more lyrical poem, things whip through the poems. And so this is called Think About It. And I think you can catch the one, three lines here when my mother enters in. Think about it. The ground's a stew of apple rot, white meat opening for bees to stick their faces to. Sometimes eyes stick out from fields. The wolfish dog's one ice blue eye, like chicory at noon. And up the road, a hunter's camouflage glove blows from one place to the next, never fitting in. This is the October I can imagine arriving without me in it. When I look up from reading, the fields a blur of crows, my eyes blurring to all but the print about primroses on page 53. They are lucidly yellow in old fields and waste places. So there are places as wasted as this valley when it's adrift in fog and voices herding cattle call out unseen. Words meaning only the world's a cold well, the bluish thunk of apples dying onto ground. Winter is almost here. I can feel it happening and want the cat to be my good omen as she rolls on concrete in the sun. An old sundial, my mind ranges to time of heat and loss. Suddenly I am lost again with my mother at the end of a car line in Havana, castanets and palm fronds clicking as we walk, not a coin jangling in her purse. Listen, why not stop all of this? Stop. Think about it or not, the mind will go on changing like apples in the sun, like crows circling the field.
Wow. Wonderful.
Nice.
Thank you.
Yeah. And that's from Shared Life.
That is from
your
a Shared
book.
Life.
All of those were from A Shared Life.
Well, the first two were
Notes
from...
Notes of Departure.
The
they were from Notes of
okay.
Yeah, that was the first book.
Notes of Departure
and
right.
then
A Shared,
a Shared Life.
Are these early books still in print?
The Iowa book, A Shared Life, is still in print.
Yeah.
The Alluvial's out of print. Cracking Eggs, I think, is
still in print.
A few of them are.
Yeah.
So it's been 10 years since I've had a book published. So these two that are coming out next year is almost like a new beginning.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Indeed. Well, let's hear another little bit of music, and we'll be right back.
Okay, thank you. All right.
It's Sunday afternoon. You're listening to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. And in the studio with me, Kathy Smith Bowers and Catherine Soniette. So thanks so much.
Wow. Catherine, those were such beautiful poems that you shared from your first two books. And I know earlier you had said that you talked about that first stage of your poetry, which is like what most of us begin with, very personal poems, and the I is the center of the poem. And then you said you started kind of tucking it under the edges, I think you said. And then you also said something about the narrative and the lyric, and I'm wondering if once you... Here's a theory I just came up with. Just this minute, I just made it up.
Oh, no.
So I wonder if the lyric doesn't emerge once we start tucking the personal under. Is that a theory that makes any sense, or...
I think that's what happened unconsciously with me, because I got tired of writing about my mother,
right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
straight on.
Uh-huh.
And it started, putting itself to the background. The next poem I'm going to read takes the mother in Havana again, but it embeds her in history.
Okay.
So I don't think I ever purposefully started out doing this, but I could see over time that's what happened.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's just as if, like, okay, I've done that. It, you know, it's work, but I feel I need to move mm-hmm. in a slightly different direction. But, of course, you've still got the same emotional material that needs to be articulated.
Right.
But you just, as you say, I love that, tuck it under the edges.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, read something else.
All right, this one is, again, this is the story of the mother and the child being lost in Havana, which was the last poem I read. Think about it, had a little snapshot of that. So this starts off more with the history of Cuba, and it's called The Beauties. The Beauties. Out of the seawall cracks, pink cosmos lean with the wind, and inland, mountain peak into thousands of feet of blue. But changes came to the farmers of high crops and to the fishers along the coast. Havana with a new bidding to bow to, boys turned to men, round stomachs flattened, then rounded again, the old again, a generation netted as crucifixes born with arms and legs. Dark eyes blinked at the castanets, ticketa ticketa tick, sunrise, a rouge tropic of cloud, goodbyes blown through breezeways of alleys. But something closed its heart and walked out of this city with the long avenidas. I traveled them once at night as a child, trolley rocking past the boulevard's royal palms. We were the stick folk then, my mother beside me like a fraught statue, riding a swath of light to the end of the line. From there I watched the colonial city wobble its candelabra, surf shaking the pier pilings beneath. I looked up at her, then on to the sky. She would not share her eyes with me. The golden rumbling machine had left us beyond Esperanza, Santo Spiritus. Stops sung out along the way. We were a duo set out to try the single life. Stars swirled round the whitewash of a city. Sea salt and green underbellies flashed in the pier light. I held to her hand while above us swayed the deep, the high, and the far.
Wow. Okay. So as that poem opens, the camera is at a distance and taking in a much larger world, and then it zooms in, so that we're back with that personal. So I really love how you do that.
People have often told me I wasn't aware of this till recently, and a friend of mine told me, he said it was like I was a bird, that I would go up very high and then
that's
come
right.
in close.
I love
high
that.
And come in close. And
I love that.
I guess that's just how I imagine things.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I feel if you get too self-conscious about your writing, it spoils things. So, you know, these things slowly come to my mind.
Right. And, you know, and you could do this the opposite way, too. you could still begin with the personal, but then as you get to the end of the poem, move out into the larger world to embrace something, you know, other than just the private
right.
world. So, but that's really beautiful. Now, so how did Havana? Why Havana?
I don't know. I know it stood out large in my child's imagination because she told me she had lost all her money.
Okay.
And we had to wire home for some money.
Uh-huh.
And I can just remember tagging on to her hand, and we got on a streetcar and went all the way out to the end of the line to a fishing pier, and we just sat there. And people say, you have such a wonderful memory of the past, but my memory is not good at all. It exists in photographic snapshots.
Right.
And then there's nothing there. So I think my life as a poet has been making a quilt of this, so that now I feel like I do have a past that I have created myself with threads.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're creating a gorgeous quilt.
Well, thank you.
A beautiful quilt. And so this, you're reading now from?
Alluvial.
Mm-hmm. Alluvial. Can we have another one from this?
Yeah, alluvial marks that move into the natural world because alluvium are the strata in a river bottom. And I found that my father's from the Chesapeake Bay area, my mother's from Louisiana, and they're two very watery places. So as I wrote two sets of poems that were personal, I also was doing historical poems, and I had no idea how they were going to fit together. Mm-hmm. And I found that my imagination, sure enough, chose things from the historical scene that were very pertinent to my personal life.
Mm-hmm.
So I embedded them in the... and I've often hoped that people would read the book carefully and see that move from poem to poem. That most of the books I have written, I have designed to be read straight through. And the books that I'm working on now have to do with the Grand Canyon. And so I have moved from the water stratification, the alluvium, to the stratification of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, Catherine, do you think that this is similar to T.S. Eliot's idea of the objective correlative, finding the thing outside of the self, that objective thing that correlates to the emotional energy?
I do. Yeah, I do. And the Chilean poet.
That's how I've understood, you know, what...
To tell your story through the landscape or through the geology or through the history. Mm-hmm. And at WordFest, we had the wonderful Chilean poet.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember his name.
Raul Zurita.
And he told the whole history of the horrors there through the landscape.
Yeah, it was amazing.
And I was very impressed with that for many reasons.
Right. Yeah, that was an amazing reading.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So I thought I would move to some very short poems now because they start considering the environment and the place and the land itself. And I'm going to start with alluvial. And alluvial, if you stand downriver from Baton Rouge where the oil refineries are, you see the whole night sky lit up like there's a war going on. So this is the title poem, Alluvial. Pieces of levee towns swirl by, Batura farmyards drown in the river. The stilt house leans one day closer to the water, its rooftop goat bleating about a place as old as spring. Then fog settles in again and tents with oil refinery fires, like night bombings wars and wars away. In this confusion of twilights, mist bathes each broken beginning.
Wow, I speak often of abiding images and that rooftop goat.
You see that?
Wow.
Qualifies.
That qualifies.
The whole barnyards get up on the roof of the levee houses when the water comes up under the stilts.
Yeah.
You'll see chickens, but that goat. One time I saw they have a path, a swinging bridge over to the house, and somebody had all their money hung out to dry. They had closed tents with all their money.
Well, you certainly do have a way of recreating those powerful details and images, Catherine.
Thank you. I wanted to be a photographer, but I never could get my hands to work quickly enough. So
well,
I
are.
Love photography. Uh-huh. Yes, yes. Thank you very much.
Yeah, your website has some photographs, I think, that you've taken.
It looks very egotistical because it's just me. But when I travel, I got grants from Virginia Tech to go places and write poems. And I have to travel by myself or I don't digest things in the same way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. That's that website, for those of you out there in Radio Land, is KatherineSoniat.com.
Yes.
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 Right. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Do check it out.
When did you leave Louisiana?
I left Louisiana in 1985.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you went
at Virginia Tech.
Virginia Tech.
And I taught at Hollins. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
And I came here because it was mountains, and I couldn't go home again for many reasons. Katrina was one of them.
Okay.
The day that I built a small house in Black Mountain, the day the foundations for my house went in there, Katrina struck New Orleans. So that was a clear message.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So you now live in Black Mountain.
Well, I moved from Black Mountain to Kenilworth. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted trees, and I didn't like living in a subdivision.
Right. And you teach at UNC Asheville.
I teach in the Great Smokies program.
Oh, yes.
And I'm going to be teaching a workshop this fall on dream and photography and writing.
Oh, wow.
So please check.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Yeah. We'll say that again at the end of the show. Because
okay.
For sure.
Don't you love teaching in that Great Smokies program?
Oh, it's a wonderful program. It really is. They get fine students, and I just couldn't think more highly of it.
It is wonderful. And I'm, you know, with my new position, I'm having to pull back and, you know, for a couple of years, but I'm really going to miss that. I have just
Well, your students are going to miss
it.
You. I know they love you dearly.
Oh, love it, love it, love it. So, yeah, let's remember to say that again before we end the program today.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Right.
So. Okay, I'm going to read a poem that actually comes from one of my early books, and this is one of those short ones, and it's about the animals in the Museum of Natural History. Again, I think that my work starts to cameo and spotlight different things quickly as it moves. Still, the title is Still Life with Grass, Fur, and Air at the Museum of Natural History. Between the surfacing blue whale and Hope Diamond, there's a hallway of suns and small arrested hearts. Deep in this corridor, I watch flared nostrils drained of forest breath, and mountains in flattened panorama behind this figment of a caribou. He stands so quiet and elegant, full of summer grass, but with such an easy eye turned away from the plain.
Wow, that is, what a snapshot. Mm-hmm. What a snapshot. Just beautiful.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Who were your the poets whom you read as you were developing your own voice, your own craft?
Well, I was a history major in college, so I wasn't even an English major, and I started writing pretty much on my own and took a couple of night school classes and just fell in love with the writing process. So I think poetry came to me. I didn't go after it, but once I started reading poems, I loved Rilke's Dueño Elegies.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
There are writers today who both are novelists who I aspire to be like, and one is W.G. Sebald. He's a German writer. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Who has a book called Rings of Saturn, and he combines history and essay and fiction, and he even uses old photographs, and it's just unbelievably beautiful.
Hmm.
And
sounds
Haruki
like a rich
Murakami, who's a Japanese writer, who sort of does that very dreamy sort of world also.
Hmm.
Now, had you read those two all...
No, I had not when I was young.
Stage because,
I hadn't read much of anything at an early stage because I just came into this in a non-credit course off the street. And I started with the process. The process is what I loved. And I remember I sent Robert Bly some poems, and he wrote back and said, "You have a wonderful gift for imagery, but your poems make no sense." But all I saw was the first part, so it kept me writing, and I thought, you know,
good,
because
most of us would see that last part and would,
no,
I was very happy with that. And at the same time, I was working with a new curator of photography at the New Orleans Museum of Art, and he was just starting the photography collection, so it was a very exciting imagistic time in my life.
Do we have time for one more little one before have some more music?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm going to read a poem called The Cup, and it's from Alluvial, and it's about the Chesapeake Bay getting very polluted. I should be reading something about the Gulf getting polluted.
Oh, yeah, boy.
I don't want to talk about the Gulf. If things are going a little bit well, we want to leave it in that direction.
Yeah.
This is about how the oysters filter the water in the bay. Mm-hmm. And without oysters, that causes a lot of contamination. the cup. Underground springs on a curl, then out in the bay, over the waves and down, an oyster at rest in its shell. Plump, gray cleanser of water, thousands of gallons for thousands of years, and always we thought the world our cup, the fresh green heft of it, sun glints at the bottom. Then that spectacle was almost all gone, gotten away, gotten way out of hand, the farm-fed rivers flushing around and around the bay, this estuary just another hole where the birds and beasts once came, filled with marsh reeds collapsing.
Wow, that's nice. You know, right now, that phrase, what was it, cleanser of waters? Cleanser of waters.
The natural life being the cleanser, trees being the cleanser.
I know.
Yeah.
Wow,
scary.
That certainly does resonate these days.
So I like that idea of the world being our cup. We think we can just lift and throw down our throats, so to speak.
Yeah.
We can't.
I know, and those poor old oysters and trees working so hard to keep this place clean, and then what do we do to it?
Powerful.
We'll be right back.
Okay. Thank you.
afternoon, and you're listening to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. With me in the studio today, Kathy Smith Bowers and Catherine Soniat. This is the sixth of our Laureates Radio Hours.
Yes, it is.
A memorable
event. Yes, it is. And what a pleasure to have Catherine Soniat with us today. She's sharing with us the different stages of her own development as a poet, and these poems, Catherine, are just so evocative and so inspiring. I want to go and write some new poems just listening to you. And it's always a pleasure to find a poet who makes me want to write poems.
Because, thank you so much.
Well, what are you going to share with us now?
Well, I'm going to move into my last segment of development here, and we're going to move into geology and geography, the Grand Canyon, the strata of the earth. And I'm going to start with a poem that is called Cameos, and it's about a train light at night. If you've ever seen a train in the country, how it swings its light back and forth and lights up different parts of the landscape, which I strive to do in my poetry. It's the first poem in Cracking Eggs. It's called Cameos. When the train moves off, I watch its headlights circle, a cool white finger gliding from spruce to spruce. Bit by bit, it picks out and lights a world, a hawk roosting its life away on little more than air, and the skull of last year's fox nailed to a tree. Sometimes it all comes clear, the moon pouring vivid branches through each window. Why can't every moment crack open like those trees so full of revelation when the train wanders at midnight? I see the train light pause and take one snowy skull, saying, "This is it." Then it moves on, saying the same, over and over, the same.
Wow. The thing I love about your work, Catherine, is that I'm always surprised at where it takes me to, but it always seems like the perfect place.
Thank you. Beautiful
job with that. And that wonderful hawk roosting its life away.
Thank you. Well, that's why I like the lyric, because the lyric surprises me. Mm-hmm. And with the narrative, I know what I know the story that I'm going to tell. Mm-hmm. So I enjoy lyrics, and I enjoy dream poems immensely, too, because I learn a lot about myself and my own writing with that.
Do you keep a dream journal or
I sort of tend to dream very archetypal dreams, and when a big dream hits, I take some notes on the imagery in it. I usually don't try to take it apart. A lot of times I'll draw a little picture of it. Mm-hmm. It's no picture that anybody would know anything about but me.
Right.
But I know Joyce Carol Oates said one time she kept a journal, and for instance, if her dog had died on a certain day, all she would write down is cooking split pea soup.
Huh.
And so one of those, use one of the senses, and it reminds you of the day the dog died. Or the dog had puppies. We don't have to kill the dog.
Right. Right. Could be a happy event, rather.
Right.
Yeah. Poor old dog.
I'd like to read one more here and then move on to poems that are in Bright Stranger, which is the book I just finished.
Oh, great.
This one is about the Gulf of Mexico, and I hope that it will be heard by the Gulf of Mexico so it can return to this state of clear green. It's a poem about going as a 12-year-old to Seagrove Beach, which is the highest point on the Gulf. I think it's 35 feet above the Gulf. And there's some skinny dipping in it by my parents.
Ooh. All right.
It's oranges. It's called Oranges and Rum at Noon. That wasn't me drinking. It was them.
Mm.
A radio violin slips through the air like heat loose in the palmettos. The Seagrove Market leaning wooden and sandy as 30 years ago, its corner phone still the one phone, sun deepening the gulf of that old to that old clear green. And maybe you are up the road again, behind the door we slammed on each other after 2 weeks too much vacation at 13. Azalea Street curves on the bluff above the sea, and that man and woman from the summer cottage seem in the salt air too. Oranges, rum on the porch at noon, and the inland lake swimming on their bare skins all afternoon, and you and I taken in, imagining it easy for lives to glisten like that. That my friend went with me. I had another 12-year-old friend, mm-hmm. and so that's the you
I was wondering
addressed
who the you
in
was
the poem.
Yeah.
So we thought this was a beautiful fairy tale of
mm-hmm.
rum on the porch and swimming mm-hmm. around in the Gulf without any clothes on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or as I say, naked in the South.
Naked.
I was corrected. It's naked. It is not naked.
Well, it's naked if you have no clothes on and are up to something.
Right. That's right. That's right.
If you're in the classroom teaching, it's naked.
Yeah.
Right.
If you don't have any clothes on while you're teaching, right. You're out of luck.
Wow, that was beautiful. Oranges and rum at noon.
You not good,
only your poems not only make me want to write poems, but they make me want to drink.
That's what people in New Orleans do a lot of, unfortunately. And eat and dance.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
It's fun for a while, but I was ready to go.
Yeah.
25 years ago.
So are you going to read us some poems that aren't even in a collection yet, Catherine? What are you going to share?
These are from a collection I just finished, and the collection is nowhere close to being published. And these are about the Grand Canyon. They circle around the strata of the canyon.
New work. Yeah, the
and
new
I have
poems.
Four poems here I'd like to read.
Right.
The first one is called Materialism. The original title of the poem was Shape-Shifting, which is, I think it didn't get anywhere because of the title. People thought that was too new agey.
Mm-hmm.
So materialism worked beautifully because it's about how things do not stay in place. Materialism. At night, my old house appears, its insides confused with time running out the doors and windows, each clock stopped at a different spectral point, the unmarked space of dream. Essences attract me, starting with the striated eastern sky, then moving deeply into the afternoon in the Box Canyon. Perhaps that's why I took his dare to sleep with the glyph, meaning flick of the gecko's tongue, a pleasure that starts from within, the wind making cartwheels of the sand, form unnerved. Beside me on the boulder is a line of vertebrae, tiny spine, a creature no longer. I, too, am without direction, feckless and sunning on a rock. Around the pool at lunch, they're doing the desert thing, piped in water, misting us like heads of grocery lettuce. Two guys splash about with beer, yelling, "This is the worst motel they've hit all week." Freeloaders ready to vanish at a moment's notice, Budweiser stacked in their rusty pickup. I give up on George by evening, the African gray in the breezeway. He will not stop talking. Any syllable caught on the fly, this parrot repeats without forethought or reflection. Now he's a screeching eagle drifted in from the mountains, raspy voice of a solitary in the sky. The real eagle on TV concludes its 200-mile-per-hour freefall after a rabbit in the brush. What doesn't want to live inside the song of another? Take that shadow I followed this morning to the back of Boynton Canyon. Unnamed, it flew above vast splits in hematite. Me like scurrying prey in the red dirt below. Bloody earth, I thought, as a mockingbird traded places one at a time. Sort of like George, who now is upside down on his swing, squawking, "Hands off, you low-down dirty two-timer."
Wow, that line, what doesn't want to live inside the song of another? Catherine, was that one of those lines that came that just surprised you?
It was a gift.
And you
yeah.
go, wow.
Yeah.
So when you begin a lyric poem, so do you? Okay, so you don't start with a story, mm-hmm. you begin describing?
What I've been doing lately is going through 5 years' worth of journals and underlining phrases and maybe, 10 different sections that have nothing to do with each other. The underlining will start turning into a poem.
Wow.
And it creates this lyrical speed, as mm-hmm. I call it, of things moving. I had this poem separated by asterisks before,
okay.
and so it was like little photographic mm-hmm. shots, but mm-hmm. I've learned to trust the reader
mm-hmm.
and to move through the asterisk phase.
So it's the thing that unifies it is your emotional response as you you're drawn to certain lines that mm-hmm. don't seem to connect at all,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they do because it's your emotional, your own emotion that's drawing you to those particular lines.
It is. And it's so like the history poems were drawn to my personal history.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that magnet between the two, the bridge.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was materialism. The next poem works much like it, and I actually just sort of finished it last week, and it's called Less. So it's the opposite of materialism. Green shade are words I haven't thought of lately. Bread and jam, the carbs that make me move and make my stomach churn. Turds I find scattered along the canyon rim, another animal remnant left behind. The territory marked. Pee and feces, saturated fur, caught in the rocks. And one black talon, half buried, records detached waiting or flying on empty till the body dropped. Two ingredients missing here that we humans fill our mouths with, sugar and constant chatter, jibber-jabber enough to drug us while Earth is clipped from top to bottom, molten magma shifting the underworld's syntax. Spoil breath of a planet, plantless, clear-cut and beyond intervention. So let the clues of collapse be muffled by ice cream, the vocal cords and brain chilled. No more hollering back and forth on a donkey swaying up from the valley floor, and not another word from hikers about the solitary. They tisk tisk and nail me with, oh, they must have left you behind, spotting a man and boy on the trail ahead. On the trail ahead. Even my friend at home always attempts, but you have to talk to someone while you're away, dismayed at how quickly I shed the human tongue. And here they are again, clumped feces in the dirt as folks gather on a promontory and the condor glides in low. I like to see such grace, a bird that watches us coagulate and separate, alert to any sign of final stillness. One or more of our unhappy endings. And chances are good that will happen if Condor circles long enough, each of us a morsel fallen away from the herd like starving sheep.
Mm. Boy, that one lifts us way up above mm-hmm.
the Condor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think I'm part bird.
Gorgeous.
Thank you.
Gorgeous.
It's hard to see how these parts fit together. I've just got to. It's like jumping in the water and learning how to swim. You just jump and you stand. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I edit and rework it a
sure.
lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I had another full. I think titles are really important, especially for my work. It holds it together. Mm-hmm. So I like the title Less, because this is
right.
heading mm-hmm. in the direction
yeah.
of less.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Kind of appearing away.
I've got two more here. Do I have time?
Yeah, you've got about 4 minutes.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I don't want to stop you from talking. All right.
No, we want to hear you.
This is called Shade, and it's about time. It's a contemplation of time and different kinds of clocks, and again, the geography around the canyon. Shade. I track it through the branches, then deeper into the woods, flickering variances in green, splices of sunlight we measure time by. Remember the ancient water clock, how it marked the molecules with logic, the chirp of water, our need to always know what time it is one step closer. Shade clock, sundial, brass pendulum with its propensity to fall toward Earth again, the gravity of time, seconds that tick and tock and trick us into thinking water's the same twice. Go figure time in the river, as if they hold the twin of all that disappears. This afternoon I felt for shadows under the leaves and wanted to be like that, dark and humid, aloneness. Not these passing thoughts, my questions answered by minutia, equivocation. Soon winter, headlights will be pale and jumpy on the ridge, travelers lost in snow. Once I struck a match and four glyphs brightened, then went out on a limestone wall, and I walked down a path that ended at the river. At noon, it stopped by water. That's where face down I floated, naked, on the current, my body offering an anemone to each small thing below.
Nice.
Oh, wow, those are so beautiful. Do we have time for one more?
Let's do it. You know, we can actually, there's nothing
let's
after
hear,
us.
Okay.
Let's hear it.
Let's hear one. Let's hear
this
one
is
more.
One I just wrote last week, and it was written for a Buddhist, a very good friend of mine who died. And it's talking somebody through the last moments of their life. Illumination, when someone is luminous in Buddhist terms, they get enlightened and they sit on that cushion long enough. So I saw this person, his face actually turned white. He smiled, coming out of a stupor. And he just lit up and then went back. So that when you hear the word luminous, it's called away. Her promise this time was to stay at his head, her fingers tracing the third eye into a fountain on his forehead, up and out of the hospice, over the garden wall. Her word stay, mistaken as her demand from months before, he responded, "No, I will not leave again, you again." He stayed and she stayed, the looping path, tail to mouth, circle the bed, feeding. Time balled up, only the days left to count forward. His voice disappearing, the vocal cords sighed a bit, the syllabics of this life done. Silence seeped into every muscle, tendon, a visceral stillness. His lungs kept breathing, no motion but hers from that afternoon from that last afternoon in the shade slatted room, the Dalai Lama's chant echoing as it had for weeks. The fans squeaked back and forth with her blowing breath on him. He received her like a sail. Old Fudo, she told him, was at his knee purring, the ocean vast and free, a tiller under his hand. In a strange, fierce tongue, she spoke of what was no more. She blew wind upon him and the mouth he could not close. She breathed him in. Deeply she took him back. Not much there to release, diminished relic of a man, something Franciscan, frail and medieval about him. Glass of water on the table, his straw, a void to fill, and she sang Solomon's, "Rise, my fair one, for lo, winter has departed and the rains are gone," and more and over again, and the Buddha remained on the windowsill with a pack on his jade back. When there had still been time to plan, she asked her lover to travel to the Himalayas to come away, and he said, "No need to go anywhere," suddenly luminous in the pillows.
Nice. Thanks so much.
Thank you. This has been a great pleasure to be able to be with you all and have you lead me through all of it.
And Catherine, you're going to be, tell us about one more time about that class that you're going to be teaching and when
I'm
going to
be teaching. It's billed as a poetry workshop, but I'm taking fiction writers who would like to work on prose poems, and we're going to be using dreams, memories, and photography to get our imagery from. It'll be on Wednesday nights from 6 to 8:30 at the Randolph Learning Center.
Wow.
So
and
anybody
is that limited to a certain number of students?
I hope. Yeah, I'm sure it is, but I need enrollment at this point.
I was going to say people need to hurry up, and that's.
I don't think they've even put it up yet.
Okay.
But
okay.
Check on the Great Smokies Writing Program in August, probably.
Catherine Sonia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This was such a gift.
Well, I enjoyed doing it so much.
Thank you.
For this week. Thanks so much to Kathy Smith Bowers and Catherine Soniat. Be sure and check out Catherine's website at catherinesoniat.com And for more information about today's program, you can check naturespoetry.blogspot.com, and I'll probably have a program note and certainly a link to the archive. So thanks so much, and thanks for listening.